content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. This is Karen Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Modern Maturity. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from various sources. So today we're going to start with another blog from Ursula Le Guin's book, No Time to Spare. This one is called The Sissy Strikes Back, and she wrote it in November of 2010. I've lost faith in the saying, you're only as old as you think you are, ever since I got old. It is a saying with a fine heritage. It goes right back to the idea of the power of positive thinking, which is so strong in America because it fits in so well with the power of commercial advertising and with the power of wishful thinking, aka the American dream. It is the bright side of Puritanism. What you deserve is what you get. Never mind, just now, about the dark side. Good things come to good people, and youth will last forever for the young in heart. Yep. There is a whole lot of power in positive thinking. It is the great placebo effect. In many cases, even dire cases, it works. I think most old people know that, and many of us try to keep our thinking on the positive side as a matter of self-preservation, as well as dignity, the wish not to end up in a prolonged whimper. It can be very hard to believe that one is actually 80 years old, but as they say, you'd better believe it. I've known clear-headed, clear-hearted people in their 90s. They didn't think they were young. They knew, with a patient, canny clarity, how old they were. If I'm 90 and believe I'm 45, I'm headed for a very bad time trying to get out of the bathtub. Even if I'm 70 and think I'm 40, I'm fooling myself to the extent of almost certainly acting like an awful fool. Actually, I've never heard anybody over 70 say, you're only as old as you think you are. Younger people say it to themselves or each other as an encouragement. When they say it to somebody who actually is old, they don't realize how stupid it is and how cruel it may be. At least there isn't a poster of it. But there is a poster of old age is not for sissies. Maybe it's where the saying came from. A man and a woman in their 70s. As I remember it, they both have what the Air Force used to call the look of eagles, and they are wearing very tight-fitting, minimal clothing and are altogether very fit. Their pose suggests that they have just run a marathon and aren't breathing hard while they relax by lifting 16-pound barbells. Look at us, they say. Old age is not for sissies. Look at me, I snarl at them. I can't run. I can't lift barbells, and the thought of me in tight-fitting, minimal clothing is appalling in all ways. I am a sissy. I always was. Who are you jocks to say old age isn't for me? Old age is for anybody who gets there. Warriors get old, sissies get old. In fact, it's likely that more sissies than warriors get old. Old age is for the healthy, the strong, the tough, the intrepid, the sick, the weak, the cowardly, the incompetent. People who run 10 miles every morning before breakfast, and people who live in a wheelchair. People who work the London Times crossword in ink in 10 minutes, and people who can't quite remember who the president is just now. Old age is less a matter of fitness or courage than of luck equals longevity. If you eat your sardines and leafy greens and wear SPF 150 and develop your abs and blabs and slabs or whatever they are in order to live a long life, that's good, and maybe it will work. But the longer a life is, the more of it will be old age. The leafy greens and the workouts may well help that old age to be healthy, but unfair as it may be, nothing guarantees health to the old. Bodies wear out after a certain amount of mileage, despite the most careful maintenance. No matter what you eat and how grand your abs and blabs are, still your bones can let you down. Your heart can get tired of its incredible, nonstop, lifelong athletic performance. And there's all that wiring and stuff inside that can begin to short circuit. If you did hard physical labor all your life and didn't really have the chance to spend a lot of time in gyms, if you ate mostly junk food because it's all you knew about and all you could afford in time and money, if you haven't got a doctor because you can't buy the insurance that stands between you and the doctors and the medicines you need, you may arrive at old age in rather bad shape. Or if you just run into some bad luck along the way, accidents, illnesses, it's the same. You won't be running marathons and lifting weights. You may have trouble getting up the stairs. You may have trouble just getting out of bed. You may have trouble getting used to hurting all the time. And it isn't likely to get better as the years go on. The compensations of getting old, such as they aren't in the field of athletic prowess. I think that's why the saying and the poster annoy me so much. They're not only insulting to sissies, they're beside the point. I'd like a poster showing two old people with stooped backs and arthritic hands and time-worn faces sitting, talking, deep in the conversation. And the slogan would be, "Old age is not for the young." Now I want to move on to an article from Reader's Digest, but this is a 2017 issue. But I think it's something we all need to pay attention to. Hydration isn't just vital when it's hot. Drink enough every day and your whole body will benefit. Your brain, too. And the title of the article is Water to Your Health. If you've ever been plummeted by gut-wrenching pain that comes with a kidney stone, your doctor probably handed you a surprisingly benign prescription to avoid another one. Water. Stones often form when urine doesn't have enough fluid in it to dissolve calcium and other substances the body regularly processes. When the body tries to move them along the conveyor belt of the excretion process, they get stuck and it hurts. Doctors sometimes prescribe medication to keep stones from forming, but for many people, proper hydration is the first line of defense. And some urologists say to those patients, water is your medicine. It's a notion of simply hydrating yourself to health seems like magical thinking. Consider the research that produced the claim. Study after study shows that drinking enough water fends off problems from head to toe. Water is a basic need for cellular health, says Ronald Navarro, MD, an orthopedic and sports medicine surgeon at Kaiser Permanente South Bay Medical Center in Harbor City, California. How much water depends on many factors: your weight, the climate where you live, how often you exercise. The old rule of thumb of 8 8-ounce glasses a day is not a bad place to start, but the Institute of Medicine actually recommends more for most people living in temperate climates. The clearest sign that you're well hydrated is pale yellow urine. If yours is dark yellow, down more water. An even better gauge may be how you feel overall. In fact, water can be a potent elixir for your mind and body. So pour yourself a nice big glass, sit back, and take a look at the many ways being well hydrated can help your health. 1. You'll have lots of energy. Water helps keep up a steady flow of nutrients into your cells, which boosts your energy. When you're dehydrated, cell membranes become less permeable and hamper this flow, affecting your physical and mental performance and making you feel sluggish, according to a review of hydration research conducted by scientists at the University of North Carolina and Tufts University. Next, you'll work up a sweat. A damp forehead during physical activity shows that your body is doing its job of maintaining a normal temperature, and water is key to that task. You might lose weight. A new study from the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign, involving more than 1,800 adults, excuse me, that's 18,000 adults, found that when people increased their daily water intake by 1 to 3 ounce, 8 ounce cups on top of the 4 they already drank on average, they ate less. Their food intake dropped by as much as 205 calories a day. Your memory may improve. Your brain is hugely dependent on fluid. All of those synapses and neurons need liquid to fire properly. According to a review published in the journal Nutrients, studies have consistently found that memory and attention improve in children after they take a drink of water. The research is less clear on whether this pattern holds true for adults. Your skin will glow. According to research, skin is at least 30% water. If your skin cells don't get the water they need, they'll start to wither and shrink. But if you drink enough water, your skin cells will plump up, minimizing the appearance of wrinkles. You'll more easily kick cold symptoms. There's a reason your doctor tells you to drink more when you're coming down with something. Your body has to launch an attack against germs when you're sick. Your runny nose, for instance, is your body's way of flushing out pathogens. That means your cells need more fluid to keep up with the demands. Drinking water also helps loosen mucus and keep your nose and throat moist. You'll keep things regular. Water interacts with dietary fiber in the digestive tract to bulk stools, said Jordan Karlitz, MD, FACG, professor of clinical medicine at Tulane Cancer Center. By staying hydrated, you can reduce the risk of constipation. You'll be in a better mood. When women in a small study from the University of Connecticut lost just 1.36% of their body mass through sweat and didn't drink enough water to replace it, their moods soured and they were more likely to experience headaches and fatigue. You'll feel strong when you work out. Water helps your muscles keep the right balance of electrolytes, such as sodium, potassium, and magnesium, to function properly. Without water, muscles can be more prone to cramping. Research suggests that even low levels of dehydration may impair physical performance. Tricks to make sure you're getting the water you need. Set alerts on your phone to remind you to drink. Use a permanent marker to draw water levels and specific deadlines on your water bottle. Refrigerate it. Although temperature preferences vary from person to person, you're likely to drink more water if it's cold, according to Joan Larson, MSRDLD, a Denver-based dietitian and creator of the nutrition website Ask the Dietitian. And that's at dietitian.com. Drink a glass before you eat anything. If you get tired of good old-fashioned H2O, consider upping your hydration game by making your brew sparkling or flavored. Water with bubbles offers the same benefits as regular water, and fruit adds taste. But steer clear of tonic water, which has added sodium and sugar. You can also munch on fruits and vegetables with high water content, such as watermelon, cucumbers, tomatoes, grapes, and cherries. Herbal teas, milk, and sports drinks can help you stay hydrated as long as they're not overly caffeinated or sugary. Caffeine may have a mild diuretic effect, stimulating your kidneys to excrete water, while sugary soda, explains Larson, will pull water from your surrounding tissues to dilute the concentrated sugar in sodas, thereby reducing your hydration. Now let's move on to an article from the AARP Bulletin. This is in Your Life section. Your restaurant safety checklist. 8 things to look for when dining out during the pandemic. Restaurants have a lot on their plate to keep diners safe this winter. In warmer months, they could expand outdoor dining to minimize the risk of COVID-19. But as dining shifts indoors, where permitted, and with a cold weather wave of new coronavirus infections on the rise, restaurants will be going to great lengths to project a sense of cleanliness and safety. We all know the basics already. Spaced out tables, staff wearing masks, hand sanitizer clearly available, special setups for takeout. But what else can you do if you choose to eat out to make sure the venue you're going to is doing all it can to protect you? First, check the tables. They should not be set in advance during the pandemic. Your server should bring cutlery wrapped in a sealed napkin or in a bag, shared salt and pepper shakers, ketchup and mustard bottles, and sugar pourers are also no-nos now. Instead, the restaurant should provide individual packets upon request. That's downgrading the experience but keeping you safe, says Robert Irvine, chef and host of the Food Network's Restaurant Impossible, which has recently focused on helping restaurants survive the pandemic. Then check the restroom. That's the first thing Irvine would do, even before the pandemic started. If the restaurants are clean, you should feel confident that the kitchen is too. A poorly kept restroom is a sign that the staff does not take cleanliness seriously, Irvine says. Then check the menus. Restaurants should now use disposable paper menus or give you a QR code to review the menu on your phone. Be wary of a plastic menu. It may not have been properly sanitized. We want to trust people to clean correctly, but unfortunately, over time, they become complacent, Irvine says. Then check the server's hands. They should have gloves on. Anyone behind the bar should be wearing gloves as well, especially when handling citrus to add to drinks. For extra safety, check the kitchen. It's well within reason for you to ask to peek inside the kitchen, Irvine says, and a red flag if the staff says no. Not all states mandate mask wearing in restaurant kitchens, but anyone cooking foods should still be doing so. It's a fire hazard to wear gloves near an open flame, but watch for chefs to don gloves before plating food or making salads. Check the restaurant's certification. In response to the pandemic, the National Restaurant Association launched the Serve Safe Dining Commitment, a program assuring customers that participating restaurants are following recommended safety protocols. Similarly, Jan de Roquefort, a co-founder of Bocaria Restaurants, created Safe Eats, a nonprofit helping the restaurant industry to safely reopen. Look for stickers or seals in the restaurant windows for either program. Check the restaurant's website or social media. A caring restaurant details the procedures it is following to keep diners safe. Avoid restaurants that don't acknowledge the pandemic at all, de Roquefort says. And finally, speak up. Just as you would tell the management if you're unhappy with your meal or service, you should also feel free to ask for proper safety measures. If that's not honored, de Roquefort says, you should be free to leave. And the author of this is Kelly Ogletree, who is a wellness and lifestyle journalist whose work has appeared in more than 30 publications. Now, also from AARP Bulletin, this is a Q&A by Margaret Atwood. Everybody has creativity. It's a human thing. The 81-year-old author of The Handmaid's Tale and a new book of poetry, Dearly, reflects on the joys and perils of late-life creativity and what she's hopeful about now. Question. At last count, you've published 17 novels, 16 books of poetry, 10 books of nonfiction, 8 collections of short fiction, 8 children's books, and 3 graphic novels, as well as other work. What's your secret? I don't think I have a secret as such, except I suppose you could say I'm not very easily discouraged. Question. Does that determined attitude go back to your childhood? Yes, it probably does. I think it has to do partly with growing up in the woods without electricity or running water during wartime, which means you didn't have a lot of stuff. There were always workarounds. If you couldn't do it this way, there was some other way of doing it. You learned a lot about levers and pulleys and little pieces of bending wire that you would never throw out because they could come into handy later. And you applied that to writing? Yes, little pieces of bendy wire in a drawer. Sooner or later, you'll use them for something else. Your observation of detail is remarkable. Do you write things down in journals, or do you just keep it all in your head? I have a memory that's like your granny's attic, full of junk, but you never know what you might find. If I'm working on a project like The Handmaid's Tale, I save things that are pertinent to that. But really, I just remember a lot of stuff. Do you have any special rituals you use when you need to create? I would love to say I did, but unfortunately, it wouldn't be true. Some people have special pens or can only write in a cork-lined room, like Proust. But what happens if you lose that special pen or you're not in that cork-lined room? Things aren't going to work for you, are they? What do you think is the biggest misconception about creativity? I think one of them is that only geniuses have it. But in fact, everybody has it because it's a human thing. It's just that people employ their creativity in different ways. Some people write, some people knit, some people make music. But it all has to do with our human capacity for invention and for seeing things from different points of view. I love a poem in your new poetry collection, Dearly, that pokes fun at the notion of aging into wisdom. What wisdom can you share? Well, I don't know whether people who have wisdom think that they have wisdom. They probably just think they're having life experiences. Are there aspects of your writing that become easier as you age? No, I'm afraid not. It's the same blank page with nothing on it. Everybody has that page, and everybody has that moment of having to begin. And what gets harder? I can't tell you that yet. I'm not old enough. What impact has fame had on you? I'm Canadian, so we take a dubious view of fame. We think it's in slightly bad taste. If I were American, it would be different. Americans love fame. I just soft-pedal it here because it would be considered in slightly bad taste to go around acting as if you're famous. The most famous I got, in a visible way, was when the person who is now the premier of our province said, "Margaret Atwood? Who's she? I wouldn't recognize her if I passed her on the street." It was about libraries. They had closed a bunch of them in the city, and that caused the most frantic uproar. So I made a thing about it. I would be going down the street and people would say, "Margaret, I recognize you." Is it hard sometimes being a cultural icon? I don't think of myself as a cultural icon because I know what happens to icons. You don't actually want to be an icon because once you're an icon, you're made of wood and you don't do anything anymore. Do you feel freer now? As an older person, you're actually quite a lot freer, which is why there are so many pesky old ladies and men around. They're freer to speak their minds without getting into horrible trouble, except possibly with their bridge club. What do you want your legacy to be? I'm not interested in having a legacy because you can't control it. If you follow the careers of writers who have passed on, they can go many different ways. You can be very popular and famous in your lifetime and then completely forgotten 50 years later. Or you can be somewhat obscure during your lifetime and then be very famous afterwards. Or you can be neither. What I say to young people is that there are four kinds of books. Good books that make money, good books that don't make money, bad books that make money, and bad books that don't make money. Of those four, you can live with three of them. What gives you hope now? I'm hopeful about young people because they're taking an interest in the future of the planet. And I'm also hopeful about America, at a time when some Americans are not, because I don't think it's over for America yet. I think America is an ornery and diverse enough place that it would be very hard to get everybody to line up and do some weird kind of salute, even though the country has had a fascist undercurrent since the 1930s or so. I'm counting on Americans' crankiness and orneriness to keep things from going too far in either extreme. And this was an interview with Margaret Atwood, and the person interviewing her was Hugh D'Alante. Now, in the little time we have left, let's talk about your bookcase as a backdrop. Video calls reveal what's behind you, how to upgrade your image. 2020 has been the year of the bookcase. We've noticed journalists and celebrities on TV perched in front of their titles and trinkets. You just know they put great care into what will make them seem smart, friendly, or funny. Take note. Whether through a computer camera or in person, you'll have visitors again eventually, people assess you by your bookshelves. 1. Think thematically. Arrange by subject, size, color. The answer, how you organize books isn't as important as being organized. Once you really start looking at books, you notice all of these decorative elements, said Marie Proler Houston, author of Decorating with Books. 2. Pull out a favorite. Don't just line up all the books as if in library stacks. Place one or two front side out. If there's a cover that's really beautiful, if it's a vintage dust jacket, for instance, it's almost a shame to have it hidden. 3. Sprinkle in cute touches. My approach is to fill the shelves two-thirds full of books and one-third with meaningful objects, says Jennifer Books Thatcher Wine, whose company has spruced up book collections for celebrities. So, let your flare flag fly. And this was by Whitney Matheson. That was from the AARP magazine. And here we have also, welcome to your new hotel room, how health concerns are changing the way we stay. Sprayers and foggers, Marriott and Hyatt hotels are turning to the types of devices used on airplanes that mist electrostatically charged disinfectants into the air and onto surfaces. That's just one of the new things you'll find in hotel rooms. Well, folks, we've run out of time today for today's episode of Modern Maturity. Be sure to listen at the same time next week. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Karen Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Modern Maturity is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.